let's start today with the financial impact of some news out of Washington. Bypassing Congress on Saturday, President Trump issued a set of executive orders and memoranda to deliver emergency pandemic aid. Now, among them are a new supplement to the unemployment benefits and the deferral of a portion of the payroll tax. Qualifying residents in Massachusetts received their last unemployment supplement back in July. The presidential actions, they're ambiguous, they raise a lot of questions, and we begin with the financial implications here in the Commonwealth. And we want to hear from you on this subject. How badly do you feel we need aid from the federal government? How badly do you need this new unemployment supplement? And do you have faith that Congress can come to a compromise on more relief? Do they need to? Are these executive actions by the president enough? Call us with your thoughts at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So joining us now to help us think about the financial implications here in Massachusetts is Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. Marie Frances, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So let's just start with the big picture question. Will these directives have an impact on pocketbooks and families here in Massachusetts?
So these executive orders are really Band-Aid solutions. Looking at the details, they don't provide any real comprehensive financial relief for families or individuals here in the Commonwealth or across the nation, or our state and local budgets that are hurting.
So are you saying people are not going to feel any relief from these four actions?
So I mean, if we break them down, if we look at the unemployment benefits, there are some relief. There is some relief there for families, but it's smaller than the relief that the federal government has been providing, and it's very temporary. So we're pulling money. They're pulling money essentially from FEMA to support these continued $400 a week payments. And they will only last about 6 weeks. And then they're also asking the states to pitch in, which is really going to dig into what we have here in the Commonwealth to support our families.
So let me just break that down for our listeners. The presidential memoranda states that we would extend the supplemental unemployment benefits at $400 a week. 75% of that would be paid by the federal government. 25% would have to be paid by state governments. Existing funds would be directed coronavirus relief funds and essentially emergency management funds to pay for that. And there have been some reports that say the money could run out within 6 weeks. The president's memorandum, as I understand it, says it could run till December 6th or until the money runs out. It sounds like you do not feel confident that there is sufficient money there for those dollars to make it to people in any kind of extended way.
I do not. I think this recession is going to last quite some time. And Massachusetts has one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, about 17%. We have 2 million claims that have been filed since the beginning of the pandemic, and we really need longer term and adequate relief.
All right. So this is part of the other question that comes up then, because we'll hit all four segments, but let's stay on the unemployment benefits for now. Because they require a 25% payment by the state or any state, it raises questions. One, does the state have to do that? Two, does the state have the money to do it? For example, has Massachusetts already allocated its coronavirus relief funds to other things? Would it have to, you know, sort of rob Peter to pay Paul here? Could we even do it?
So essentially right now we're seeing budget shortfalls of $4 to $7 million here on the state level. So we're really struggling as a state to meet our priorities. We would have to be robbing somebody to pay somebody else, essentially. And who would be robbing is schools. We'd be robbing, you know, providing adequate healthcare to folks in order to make up and pay for this expanded unemployment insurance. Yes.
And then the question also comes up, if the state wants to do this but can't pay, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin seemed to hint on Fox yesterday that it wasn't going to be required that states dip into their coronavirus relief funds to get the other 25%. Here it is.
They can either take that out of the money we've already given them, or the president can waive that. We've been told by the states they can get this up and running immediately.
But there's nothing in writing about a presidential waiver. So from a state fiscal policy standpoint, can you in any way treat that as a real possibility, or does one have to treat it like it doesn't exist unless it's in writing?
I mean, I just think it's completely inexcusable that we don't have clear guidance on an executive order. And this has happened, with several programs that have come down from the federal government. But with this, it's needed so critically, immediately. I just feel like clear guidance is really needed on what funds we're able to use for this or not.
Okay, let's shift to the payroll tax because another thing in these memoranda were the idea that employees can delay their portion of the payroll tax contribution until January. Now, the president says if reelected, he'll get a bill passed to make that a permanent tax cut, but that's a lot of contingencies. Otherwise, the bill comes due for employees in 2021. Is this a good idea for mass residents and can it work?
So again, this is an example of something that's talked up, but in reality is not really going to help the pocketbooks of folks here in Massachusetts and across the nation. As you mentioned, it is a deferral of a tax that then an employee would have to pay unless it was extended. And I mean that's just not real relief, right? And also, if you look at the payroll tax, what the payroll tax funds is Social Security and Medicare and other things that we, need during the time of this pandemic and moving forward. So again, it's another situation of, robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Let's talk about evictions now. There is an executive order on eviction assistance. It doesn't provide a moratorium on evictions. It directs the federal government to find essentially the ability to provide additional assistance to renters. At the same time, Massachusetts has a moratorium on evictions until October 17th, which the governor extended last month. So is it important that the federal government take steps here, or do people in the Commonwealth already have sufficient protections?
There are sufficient temporary protections on evictions and foreclosures here. But the thing is, people would need real rental relief. Just, saying that you won't have to pay your mortgage for 3 months or you won't have to pay your rent for 3 months, we really need something more comprehensive because once those 3 months or 6 months come due, folks are going to have to pay those bills. I think you were clear in stating that Trump's executive order really does a lot of nothing, really. And luckily, here on the state level, we do have some protections, but again, they're temporary protections for renters and for small landlords and homeowners.
All right, so let's hit that last memorandum, which addresses student loans. This one looks like it could have some benefit for Massachusetts residents who have federally based student loan money they borrowed from federal sources. It puts a moratorium on payments and no interest through September 30th. Is that a bright spot for residents here?
So it's great. I mean, it's an extension of essentially what was in the CARES Act to freeze the payments and to freeze the interest, though it only applies for the federally backed loans, not private loans. So there are still borrowers who are left out of this.
All right. Well, we will continue to watch this and we'll look forward to more analysis from you. That's Marie Frances, excuse me, Marie Frances Rivera, President at the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. Thanks for joining
Thank
us
you.
today.
Thank you, Tiziana. Thank you so much.
Yep. And before I turn to our next guest, let's go to the phones for just a minute. Take a couple calls. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Greg is on the line from Salem. Greg, what's on your mind?
Well, the unemployment extension is going to hurt. It's already hurting. In fact, I'm at the point where I've had to contact a lawyer so I can be prepared to file Chapter 7 if things don't improve and I can't find work.
I'm sorry to hear that, Greg. And would this extra $400 a week make a difference in staving that off for you?
I think it would. I mean, five or six, it makes me a little bit more solvent for the short term. It buys me time. Four is kind of on the bubble. But I'm sure there's people that are worse off than me that has a bigger impact.
Well, Greg, I'm wishing you well, and I'm glad you called in. Thank you. And let's take one more call. We've got Dave from Yarmouth. Dave, go ahead.
So we just have to figure out how much money it's going to cost. I mean, which is worse, printing more money or giving people a little bit less money on unemployment in an effort to hope to get them back to work. So there's a trade-off. Either your last guest said you had to pay Peter to pay Paul, Rob from Peter to pay Paul. We're doing the same thing if we give extra benefits. We don't have that kind of money. We just print it. Eventually, that's got to catch up with us.
All right. Thanks for expressing that concern, Dave. And that's a good chance for us to turn to our next guests, because we want to look at these executive actions, what they might mean for the future of Corona relief, what they mean legally, and what Congress and Massachusetts congressional delegation should do next, given that they're out there. We are joined by Michael Capuano, former Massachusetts congressman and now the public affairs director for Foley and Lardner. Welcome back.
Hey, Tiziana. Nice to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, too. And also with us is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston to you, too.
Good to be on.
And listeners, keep calling in with your thoughts and your questions. There are questions, constitutional questions here, questions about whether Congress should act in addition or independently, whether it should push back legally. What are you thinking about the status of our coronavirus relief? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So let me just invite both of you, and Congressman, maybe I'll start with you to reflect on this conversation you just heard. Could these benefits make a substantial or measurable difference for Massachusetts residents?
They'll make a difference to a handful of people, and they, you know, you'll take what you can get in tough times. But they will not make a difference to the general economy. They will not make a difference to millions of people in this state. To be perfectly honest, this is really mostly a political ploy and game by the president to avoid legitimately negotiating with people he doesn't agree with, and to look like he's doing something when, in fact, he's doing virtually nothing.
You know, I was thinking about that. We've had a number of representatives from our delegation on over the last few weeks. Several of them expressed, I guess optimism is a fair word, or at least a belief that Congress would get something passed. They haven't. If the president had not done this over the weekend, Congressman, would something have happened, or would we still just be back and forth in these negotiations?
Well, you can't do something without the president. I mean, the presidency is required to be put at the table. And let's not forget that his friends run the Senate as well. So there has to be a compromise. I actually believe there will be one. It shouldn't be taking this long. All the things I have read and the people I've talked to clearly indicate that there's lots of middle ground, that compromises could be found. But you can't find a compromise if you're not looking for one.
Judge Gertner, on Sunday on Fox, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had some very strong words about the president's actions. Here she is.
What the president did is, I agree with the Republican senator, said it was unconstitutional slop.
So I'm going to leave the slop piece out, but I am going to ask you about the constitutionality of these three memoranda and this one executive order.
Well, there's a difference between the orders that are directed at the reappropriation of money, that essentially shifting money from one federal fund, in this case FEMA, to unemployment relief. That's in one box. Put that aside. And the other, of deferral of payroll taxes and deferral of student loans, in another box. The issue of changing the appropriation of money from one box into another can be challenged, and it sounds like it will be challenged, because the appropriation power rests with Congress, full stop. Now, there's some leeway in that, but the appropriation power and the final analysis rests with Congress. Congress, the president can't say Congress appropriated the funds to X. Never mind. There's law that he can't say, I'm not going to spend it. He can't say, I can't spend it for other purposes. And so this money is coming from the FEMA budget and is going into this relief. In addition, there are issues, both political and practical, about directing the states to contribute what they, the remaining 25%. That's interesting as to where the source of that would be. The other orders, with respect to deferring student loan repayment and the payroll tax, is within the president's authority up to a point. Forgiving the tax is not within the president's authority. Deferring it to a limited degree is within his authority. And the student loan issue, in fact, he could defer that indefinitely and even forgive those debts. But taxes, again, that's part of the constitutional authority. He can defer. He can't say never mind with respect to that. So he's really on, constitutional quicksand. I won't put it in Speaker Pelosi's way, but this is quicksand.
But the president did say that it was a deferral on the payroll tax unless he got reelected, at which point he would get a bill passed that would then make that a permanent So that right. would be legal to do it that way, right?
That's right. That is the only way he can do it, bearing in mind, again, as your previous speaker said, the payroll tax funds Social Security and Medicare. So deferring it only depletes those trust funds even more at a time when people need it. That's not a legal issue, but that certainly will be a political consideration.
And I just want to backtrack for a minute, too, and make it clear to our listeners that the money that the president was talking about reallocating, there's a $44 billion reserve associated with FEMA. And the memorandum basically says we'll spend down until there are $25 billion left or until December 6th, whichever comes first. And then, as we heard in the first segment, there's some controversy about whether that money would last to anywhere even close to December 6th. Congressman,
right.
let me
and
just give you a chance
to... Especially in the context of a hurricane season that is reportedly more active this year than it will be in previous years.
Excellent point, and a big source of concern. So, Congressman, let me just give you a chance first to react to what you just heard from Judge Gertner.
Everything Nancy said was 100% right. She just said it more politely than I might have.
Well, I'll use that chance to put the number out to our callers, too. 800-423-8255. Call in politely and tell us what you're thinking about these executive orders and memoranda. How important are they? And what else needs to be done? And I'm going to come back to you on this, Congressman. You talked about the fact that you still think something is going to, that Congress is going to do something. President Trump said on Saturday he blames Democrats for stalling the bill and that he had to work around them. Here he is.
We're doing that without the Democrats. We should have been able to do it very easily with them, but they want all of these additional things that have nothing to do with helping people.
Now, I understand that one party often blames the other party when the negotiation comes to an impasse, but what are the real sticky wickets in getting another bill passed?
Well, it's not just the president. It's some of his friends in the Senate and his zealot supporters out there that do. Many of whom don't believe in things like helping people who are unemployed. The fact that he came up with $400 a week as opposed to $600 extra, I'm sure pleases some people. But I'm also equally sure it has angered some of his base supporters. They don't like the idea. That's why he put 25% of it onto the states. The idea of attacking Social Security is not a new idea from this current Republican Party, not the old one, not the one that are more reasonable, but from this current, you know, these radicals that are running the party at the moment, they've been after Social Security from day one. Is it
so
a surprise that Donald Trump and his friends don't want to help people deal with the possibility of eviction in the worst economic crisis we've faced in a long time? None of this surprises me.
Are you saying that this payroll deduction or postponement, excuse me, is in fact a backdoor attack on funds for Social Security?
Of course it is. That's why the president said he'd do it permanently. And you know, that's not new. He's wanted to defund Social Security from day one. And he's not the only one. Many of his supporters in the House and the Senate want to do the same thing. And it's not new. This has nothing to do with COVID or hurricanes or anything else. They've been trying to do this for a generation. So absolutely, why would he do it permanently otherwise? I mean, if he really thought it was just a response to a crisis, that he would make it short term and then end it at the end of the crisis. I could still have the argument, but the minute I hear the word permanent in undermining Medicare and Social Security, my antennas go, they're already up, but they go up even further. is nothing more than the typical political ploy that, you know, that's a creeping socialism. And I will tell you, as a Social Security recipient, it would anger me to tell me that, you know, that it's not going to be there tomorrow. And it would anger me just as much to tell me it won't be there for my children.
So, Judge Gertner, now, obviously, one of the questions on the table is legal action. Who will take it? Will it work, et cetera? Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, said to Fox News on Sunday that he thinks challenging this in court is going to look bad for Democrats. Here he is.
I would say if the Democrats want to challenge us in court and hold up unemployment benefits to those hardworking Americans that are out of a job because of COVID, they're going to have a lot of explaining to do.
Now, there has been argument that the president is usurping Congress's power of the purse here. There's also at least an argument convincing to some to make that this puts Democrats in a really tough spot in Congress if they want to sue. I guess my question is, if they don't sue and this is a usurping of some of the power of the purse, is something permanent lost in our balance across the branches of government.
I think that that's right. I think that the issue is just as I understand, the Democrats have been holding out for a longer term, more permanent solution, which is what Nancy Pelosi was saying, rather than a short-term solution. The president has put a short-term solution before them, and indeed one that raises long-term constitutional implications that you described about how far a president could go. In addition, the payroll tax issue, this is really something Mr. Capuano, I want to call you Representative Capuano, but in any event, and that is the payroll tax reduction or deferral won't necessarily get people back to work. In other words, the implication here is that minus the payroll taxes, it will somehow be easier for people to get back to work. I don't think that that's going to happen in this pandemic. In other words, that's not going to affect an employer's calculation, oh, I can put this cook back or I can have this employee back because I don't have to pay payroll taxes. It's much deeper than that.
Congressman, what about that?
100% right. That's, 6-7%, 15%, depending on your count, of a payroll. That's not, you don't hire people on the basis of 10% difference. You have to look at the basic wage, which is really the bulk of the cost, to go with it. And also by need. People don't just hire people just for the fun of it. They hire a cook or a truck driver because they need them. They need them to conduct their business. Again, I'm not opposed to temporarily reducing certain taxes if somebody can make an argument that it helps. This is not the be-all and end-all. I am a firm believer that we need to do short-term direct support to those people who need it the most. And in this particular case, it would be those who are unemployed. They're the ones who have suffered the most. And it could be short-term. And again, you can make an argument whether it should be $600 or $400. Those are fair arguments. There's no magic number. But again, that screams for compromise. If you believe it's $600 and the president believes it's $400, you can't come up with a $500 deal. Is this brain surgery? Everybody gives a little bit, and you come up with a number that will please most people, but not everyone. And since the president's already picked $400, the Democrats seem to be stuck on $600. I propose that we just take $500. Period. Walk away, and let's get back to business and get people whole again to the best of our ability, and still deal with the crisis that we continue to have.
And Judge Gertner, in our last 30 seconds or so, are you expecting to see lawsuits?
I think so. I think that there will be, regardless of Mnuchin's comments, I think there will be because there's a principle involved. So you have an order which is not going to accomplish what the president wants it to accomplish and at the same time raise other more serious issues.
All right. And that is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner, a retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's Michael Capuano, former Massachusetts congressman and now the public affairs director for Foley and Lardner. Thanks for coming back again.
Thanks, Izzy. Nice talking to you.
The Massachusetts primaries are 3 weeks from tomorrow, and some key races here in the state are showing the strain. Over the weekend, a scandal broke in the race for the first congressional district between incumbent Richard Neal and his challenger, Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. And Congressman Joe Kennedy is taking new swings at Senator Ed Markey in his bid for Markey's seat. So here to give us an update on all of it is WBUR's Callum Borchers. Callum, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Tiziana.
All right, so let's start in the first congressional district. We have the Holyoke mayor against the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. There's a potential scandal emerging about Mayor Alex Morse. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, well, I mean, Alex Morse, up until now at least, has been viewed as kind of a political prodigy. You know, he was elected mayor of his hometown, Holyoke, at just 22 years old. He's still only 31. And he has been seen as a credible challenger to Richie Neal, who, remember, was the subject of a Globe column last year about lavish fundraisers in Washington, so perhaps seen as somewhat vulnerable. And so then UMass, over the weekend, opened an investigation of Alex Morse after the student newspaper on that campus reported allegations that Morse had abused his power to engage in sexual relationships with undergraduate men. And Morse had been a part-time professor for several years and had attended networking events for the college Democrats. And so that is what is brewing over the weekend, and it is really changing the complexion of this race, Tiziana.
Yeah. What is Alex Morse saying about the allegations?
Well, he's issued a lengthy statement in which he does acknowledge the relationships, but insists that they were all consensual. And he says that he is outraged by what he calls, quote, age-old anti-gay stereotypes. And longtime political observers here in Massachusetts may be thinking back to the late Congressman Gary Studs, remember, who was the first openly gay member of Congress, but was censured for having a relationship with a 17-year-old page when he was in his 30s. So Morse seems to be kind of suggesting that he's being unfairly portrayed in that same bucket as some kind of predator. He says that any male students in his case were adults, and he says that he is, quote, being held to a different standard, one standard that's deeply connected to a history of surveilling the sex lives of people like me. So basically, Tiziana, he's saying that these allegations are rooted in discrimination.
This sounds like it's going to be a painful unfolding, Callum. What is Richard Neal's response at this point?
Well, he is staying mum for now, Tiziana. He's declined comment so far. He seems content to just sort of let this play out in the press, at least for a little while. But the two men do have a debate 1 week from tonight. So sooner or later, you know it's going to come out in public and he's going to have to say something about it.
And in the meantime, for Morse, what about, you know, endorsement supporters? Has anything started to shift in the landscape as a result of what we know at this point?
Yeah, you know, one of his things that he said in his statement, Tiziana, was that he is releasing everyone who has endorsed him if people feel like they can no longer support him. But we haven't seen a huge wave of people abandoning him just yet. In fact, one of the key endorsers today, the LGBTQ Victory Fund, said they were going to stand by Alex Morse. And I'll just read you part of what they said. They said that, quote, Alex has been running for Congress for more than a year. And this letter was released 1 week before the first debate and 3 weeks before the primary. So the implication there, Tiziana, is that this is a sort of political hit that is timed to try to, besmirch his reputation without enough time for the university to complete an investigation and sort of resolve the matter before people vote.
And we don't have any reason to believe that the university could complete the investigation and resolve the matter in that kind of time frame, right?
No, it would be incredibly fast. I mean, what UMass has said up until now, Tiziana, is that, you know, he's not teaching classes right now and that they have no plans to hire him back to do so, at least while this investigation is ongoing. But they have not been able to complete an independent review of these student claims, no.
All right, so let's shift to the Kennedy Markey race. You pick your cliche. The gloves are off, the cleats are on, whatever you want to say. Kennedy went on the attack after showing kind of early restraint against a very popular progressive. What is he going after?
Yeah, the tone has shifted. You know, it's taken a few forms lately, Tiziana. First, Ed Markey was spending too little time in Massachusetts. That was one line of attack that we've heard in recent weeks. Another one is that Markey, in Kennedy's view, has not been strong enough advocating for immigrants. But the latest attack that he really seems to be taking a big swing on, Tiziana, is amplifying a criticism from the family of D.J. Henry. Now, Henry was a black college student who was killed by police a decade ago. And his parents say that Kennedy has been a strong ally in their quest for justice, but they also say that Markey was dismissive when they met with him several years ago. And Kennedy had been letting the Henry family do the talking on this for a while, but not anymore. Here's what he said on the campaign trail yesterday.
Parents came to a United States senator to ask for justice for their murdered son, and he did nothing. There are those wondering what the difference between the two of us are in this race. That's the difference.
So how's Markey?
I mean, this I was just going to say one last thing, which is that this sort of what's the difference between the two of you is a question that Kennedy has kind of struggled to answer in this race. And so I think that that's a key part of that response there. He's hoping that this will finally draw some separation between the two men where there hasn't been a whole lot up until now.
And I actually should ask you before I ask the next question, did that land? Are you seeing anything in political chatter or endorsements or the, you know, sort of the halls of people who talk about these things now that ad landed?
Well, Markey has not, sort of similar to Alex Morse, he has not experienced any kind of, you know, wave of endorsers abandoning him either, partly because he seems to be taking a very sort of cautious approach to his response. I mean, the way that he's approached this is to apologize to the Henry family. He's promised to do whatever he can to help them. He's asked the Justice Department to take another look at the case. There's also this matter, Tiziana, of whether Markey used the term colored people instead of people of color in conversation with the Henry family. That's one of their complaints against him. He says he doesn't recall saying that, which is not a direct denial. But I'm reminded in a way of, remember the Donald Trump feud with the Khan Gold Star family from 4 years ago?
Yes.
I think Markey is sort of taking his notes and saying there is nothing to be gained by getting into a public feud with the Henry family. And you look at how ugly that episode was between Trump and Khan. He seems to not want any part of that kind of controversy.
So where is he trying to focus? How is he trying to make his case for reelection right now?
Yeah, his strategy just basically seems to be running as the progressive candidate who was ahead of his time, you know, and the world's finally catching up to me is basically what he's saying, particularly on issues like climate change. You know, his campaign slogan, Tiziana, is leads and delivers. And right now what he's trying to deliver on is more coronavirus relief. So Democrats and Republicans are locked in this dispute, among other things, about unemployment benefits. They're arguing over whether the additional coronavirus relief should be $600 a week versus $200 a week. Right now it's zero, of course, because it expired last month. And so Markey and the Dems they're holding out for a better deal. And he tells me that he thinks the pragmatists in the Republican Party are going to give in and improve something closer to the $600 figure that Democrats want. So here's just a little bit of my conversation with the senator last week.
In my conversations with Republican senators, many of them are just frightened at the political tsunami that is headed their way because of the mismanagement of the economy and the coronavirus pandemic by the president and Republican leadership. And ultimately, I believe that pragmatic view will prevail.
And so, I mean, what I hear in there, Tiziana, is a guy who's sort of, you know, implicitly making a case for his decades of Washington experience and saying, yeah, I'm sort of taking a risk here because it's gone down to zero and people might be unhappy about that. But I think I can deliver a better deal by holding out.
All right. So before I let you go, Callum, also everyone's watching the Veep stakes, watching for Biden's VP pick this week. What is the latest on that?
Yeah, we're all watching very closely because we thought maybe it was going to come last week, and it didn't. But this would seem to be the last week to do it because, of course, the Democratic National Convention is next week. It will look very different from any that we've seen in recent years because Joe Biden will not be in Milwaukee to accept the nomination as the nominee traditionally would. He's going to remain in Delaware. Some of the same names that you've been hearing for a long time seem to remain on the short list. Kamala Harris, Val Demings, Karen Bass, Tammy Duckworth, and of course, our own Senator Elizabeth Warren. She is different from those other four, of course, because she is not a woman of color. And so this is one of the big issues that everybody's watching in the Veep stakes right now. Will Joe Biden pick a woman of color, particularly after black voters in South Carolina revived his campaign, which really was on life support in the primary season up until that point? He has not pledged that he will, but he has said that four of the finalists he is vetting are women of color. And so that's sort of what we're watching. And if you're looking for hints, Tiziana, I guess the only thing I would say is the New York Times today is reporting that Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton are going to be speaking in prime time at the DNC next Wednesday night, which maybe if you're reading the lines suggests maybe she's not going to be the pick because she's got a different slot already lined up. But of course, that could change if she is the pick. So we'll see. But this is what we're all left doing because we can't play the usual games of watching where's the Biden plane taking off for? Is he meeting with so-and-so in such-and-such city by you track the tail numbers? Because this pandemic has really thrown campaigning into a completely different world.
Well, we are going to continue to watch that completely different world unfold with you. That's WBUR reporter Callum Borchers. Thanks for joining us, Callum.
Glad to be with you.
Schools across the Commonwealth are facing such a tough decision. What is the best way to start school again in September? Remote, all in person, some combination of the two? And that translates into painful choices for students and parents, too. So for the rest of the show, we want to take your calls on schools and reopening. What's your district doing? Are you concerned? Do you want them to do what they're doing? Do you want your kids in school, or do you feel everyone needs to be home? What investments need to be made for you to feel safe for the schools to go back to the way they sort of used to be? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to hear from the superintendent of the Chelsea Public Schools. But first, we want to turn to WBUR education editor Kathleen McNerney for a quick rundown of where schools are. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Kathleen.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So we are unbelievably now in the second week of August already. When do schools have to decide on their fall plans?
So the state set a deadline of August 14th for the districts to submit their final plans. So you've probably been noticing a lot of school committee meetings and votes happening over the last couple of weeks while districts finalize what the fall is going to look like.
And I hear you've been talking to parents and teachers. And what are you hearing from them? And do they think the timing's too late, or are they patiently waiting?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stress And I think it's on both sides, to be honest, on all sides, really, from the committees that are the reopening committees and districts that are tasked with making these decisions and weighing this, as well as the parents and the teachers who are trying to plan. And I think everyone wants to figure out how to meet everybody's needs. And there's no easy answer in a time like this. One thing that came up as you know, I've been working on talking to a lot of different parents from different communities about their perspectives, and trust and communication seems to be playing a large role. Rich Perona of Lexington, I spoke with, he has an incoming kindergartner and a second grader, 5 and 7 years old. And really for him, he wants parents to have a choice to go fully back in person. Here he is.
Trust is completely gone. I think they have to do way better for the amount of taxes we pay here. So, you know, the teachers are here for a reason, to teach. I hope they can. I hope they do it safely. But at the same time, you got to go back. You got to do your job.
And at the same time, the teachers I've talked to, they do want to do their job. At the same time, you know, but there's a public health crisis and information is still emerging. Our understanding of the virus, how it spreads, who's affected by it, and how who's at risk. Who's at increased risk, who's at lower risk, is hard to parse through. The Lexington School Committee votes tomorrow night. I will note that they did 4 different surveys of the parents, and it's not uncommon. A lot of these districts have been putting out surveys to try to get a bead on what parents are feeling when it comes to reopening, what their needs are, what didn't work about remote learning that they could make better. And in the most recent survey, Lexington parents were asked about their return. About 63%, the district tells me, showed an interest in remote and hybrid models, and about 37% of families wanted a full return to school.
Now, before we bring the superintendent in, I want to have her join us soon. Can you kind of give us the breakdown, Kathleen, of how school plans are panning out? How varied are they? Are the vast majority hybrid? You know, what are we looking at?
They are varied, and I would say the vast majority seem to be falling under the hybrid model. The latest data that our team got from the state on Friday afternoon was showing that the by and large, the majority was going into hybrid with a few remote and a few in person. And what I saw, you know, we started going through a handful, about 24 of these plans. And there are some districts that are trying to really give priority to full in-person learning for the students they feel need it the most. That would be younger kids. It's really hard to teach reading, for example, on Zoom or in a Google Classroom. And that would be kids with special education needs that to try to, a lot of districts are giving parents choice, but trying to give those students an option to come into the classroom to try to get those services that they really need that can't be delivered remotely, and can't be delivered remotely well if they can be. But we are seeing most hybrid. A few have started to, even though they said hybrid, they're starting to switch to all remote. I think it's in line with what we're seeing of in terms of COVID cases. It really is community by community. But a lot of teachers that I talked to on Friday and over the weekend said, you know, the governor said that groups should be scaled back from 100 to only allowing 50 people to meet in groups. So some teachers and parents were like, well, if that's scaling back, shouldn't schools, because you're talking about getting hundreds of students and teachers into these buildings at a time. So it's still really, really in flux.
So WBUR Education Editor Kathleen McNerney, I'm actually going to ask you to stand by. I want to keep you here, but I'm going to add another voice to our conversation. Joining us now on the line is the superintendent of Chelsea Public Schools, Almi Abeta. Dr. Abeta, Superintendent Abeta, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I should note that we were also going to have Boston Public Schools Superintendent Brenda Caselius with us for this conversation, but they had to cancel last minute this afternoon, so we'll see if that superintendent can join us another day this week. And listeners, call in. What is your district doing? What questions do you have for a superintendent about how these decisions are getting made? And how about the timing? Do you have the information you need in time to make the plans you need to make? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Superintendent, according to the town-by-town data, Chelsea is still a hotspot in Massachusetts, number one out of 351 cities and towns. So let me just ask, how are you? How are things in Chelsea?
Well, right now, we complied with the Department of Education. We submitted our preliminary plans to do full in-person, hybrid, and then remote learning. As we've been monitoring our data, as you just said, we have an infection rate of 4.93% positivity rate as of August 5th. So in light of that information, we have decided that we would start, we're going to do remote learning in the fall with the phase in. And for us in Chelsea, we really have to monitor the percent positivity rate before we can open schools safely.
And your positivity rate there in Chelsea is just below 5%, correct?
Correct.
And we have heard from a number of infectious disease physicians here on the show over the last month or so that that 5% number is a really critical number to stay below in terms of the spread of the pandemic. Are you feeling a great deal of anxiety in your community? Are you getting it from teachers? Are you getting it from parents and families?
I believe as we've met with our families, I had a parent advisory who was working with me on the reopening of school plans. And I will say our parents were not knocking down the doors for us to reopen schools. At least 47% have already, when we put out the option, chosen online remote learning option. And what I found when we've been at the Chelsea Collaborative working with our families and listening is that because our families have had such close contact with COVID-19, whether it be a mother, whether it be an uncle, a grandma, a grandfather, the neighbor next door, because people have experienced it, they are not as, they're afraid. And they're not really wanting to be around a lot of people right now. So there is a hesitation. And so what we're finding is when I met with my parent advisory, I put the question, how are you willing to send your student to school? One parent was like, not until there's a vaccine. I was in the ICU for 11 weeks with COVID-19, and I'm not sending my child to school. So,
you know, you hear a story like that, Superintendent, thank you. You hear a story like that, and it is gut-wrenching. I mean, that is where the rubber meets the road of the level of infection and risk of this disease. And then there's this other question that constantly hovers out there as well, which is the long-term implications for learning, mm-hmm. for social-emotional Absolutely. Well-being, for access to other supports that we know young people get in a way when they are in person in the classroom that they don't get necessarily, mm-hmm. at least otherwise. How does one do that calculus? I mean, is it just 100% we can't afford infection transmission? Is there some tipping point? And how do you even, as a leader, begin to think about that?
Well, I was pushing to do in-person, hybrid, and remote learning option for a while, and until our positivity rate hit 4.9%, I just knew at that there was that threshold. It was time for me to say, oh, it's time that we have to do remote learning at this juncture. So, my school committee is voting actually tomorrow, and I've had to shift course and direction and say and propose a new recommendation that we have to start in the fall. We will monitor the positivity rate, and I'm hoping maybe in October we can open. But even as we are in full remote learning, because I am concerned about our students, and I know that for many of our students, school is a safe place. And so we're going to experiment with maybe some centers for online learning where students can come and still do their remote learning, but come to the middle and the high schools and do the remote learning physically there if possible. We'll be socially distanced because some of our students need a place that's safe where we can plug them into services if they need it. So I'm looking at that even during the full remote learning I do think it's important that we have heavy, heavy family and community engagement right up front. I want for every student to be able to meet his or her teacher, have a conversation, build those relationships, whether they can come in one-on-one and meet with a teacher or whether it's remote. We want to build those relationships up front. And we also learned a lot in the spring about remote learning, and we learned that we need to have more structure and we have to have more rigor and that we need to be more organized about it. But the key thing that we've learned is that we have to communicate better with our families and with the teacher. So there needs to be more of an outreach.
So, Superintendent Abeda, I want to turn back to Education Editor Kathleen McNerney. Kathleen, in just 60 seconds or so, how does what you're hearing from the superintendent compare with data and feedback you've heard from other school districts?
I think it's very much in line. I think that's the core tension and the reason why the state and several pediatricians groups have been pushing or encouraging full in-person return is because they know what's at stake. Not every kid has a safe home to be in. And I think they're worried about the kids that are going missing. They're worried about the kids and families that aren't able to get food. But it also has to be a full community response. Schools can't do all of this without larger supports.
And Superintendent, I want to turn back to you for a minute. As a former principal in the Boston Public Schools, as an educator, as a superintendent, do you have any good options here, and how are you feeling about the decisions that you are facing with the clock ticking now?
The options are, we don't really, as superintendents, we don't have really any great options right now. But I think at the end of the day, we have to put students and families first and the safety of our staff first. And so when you look at it that way, for me, the decision is very easy once we peaked at 4.9%. And so then the next decision that I have to make, and with my team, and I have an amazing leadership team, is, okay, how do we ensure we reach out to our families, that we have as rigorous remote learning as possible for every student, every day, in every classroom in the remote learning environment? I will say we did.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to have to stop you there or we're going to run out of show. So that is Almy Albeda, superintendent of the Chelsea Public Schools, and WBUR education editor Kathleen McNerney. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.